The headlines, a senior Iranian military commander says the U.S. will pay the price for its threatening rhetoric against the Islamic Republic. Palestinians stage a rally in the besieged Gaza Strip to voice their opposition to U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to the Israeli-occupied territories. And Italy is facing a political crisis as Prime Minister Mario Draghi tenders his resignation. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. A spokesman for the Iranian Armed Forces has warned the U.S. against its rhetoric against the Islamic Republic. This came after U.S. President Joe Biden said he is prepared to use force against Iran over its nuclear program. Brigadier General Abbas Faz Shekarchi says that the U.S. will pay the price for using that phrase, which is part of its psychological warfare against Iran. He advised the U.S. to review its previous failures, including the destruction of its Ain al-Assad military base in Iraq and its withdrawal from Afghanistan. Shekarchi also said that Washington is only trying to repair what he called its hollow grandeur and slow down the process of the collapse of the Israeli regime. Biden made the threat during his talks with the Israeli prime minister on Thursday. The U.S. and Israel accuse Iran of seeking a nuclear bomb. Tehran has time and again rejected this allegation. Saudi Arabia says that it will allow all carriers to use its airspace if they meet the country's requirements for overflying. The kingdom says the move aims to consolidate its position as a global hub connecting three continents. The decision would lift overflight restrictions on airlines traveling to and from Israel. The U.S. has praised the move, calling it the result of President Joe Biden's principled diplomacy with Riyadh. Saudi Arabia made the announcement hours before Biden's arrival there in a direct flight from Israel. Saudi Arabia's lifting of flight restrictions to Israel is seen as an apparent gesture of openness towards the regime. Back in 2020, several Arab states, including Bahrain and the UAE, normalized ties with Israel. U.S. President Joe Biden is paying a visit to the occupied West Bank. He was welcomed, by his Palestinian counterpart, Mahmoud Abbas, in an official ceremony. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall. Mona, what can you tell us about this visit?
That's right. The U.S. president arrived at Beit Lahem after, more than 48 hours to Israel. The American president just received by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Beit Lahem, in the occupied West Bank city of Beit Lahem, in a meeting that will not last for more than an hour. There would be a statement following this meeting. It's not clear up till the moment if it will be a joint press conference between Joe Biden and President Mahmoud Abbas. There were some sources saying that the officials from the American administration and the Palestinian Authority did not, agree on the exact statement that both the presidents agree on. So there were talks up till the early hours of today. There would be separate statements for the American president and then President Abbas. But up to the moment, we cannot assure that there would be a separate or joint press conference for President Abbas and Joe Biden. We have to wait. Anyways, Palestinians from the first moment were not expecting a lot from the visit of U.S. President Joe Biden. Maybe the Palestinian leadership were still hoping that Biden will come clearly and say he supports the two-state solution and that Israel should stop settlement construction. and let's say reopen the American embassy in Al-Quds as well as the PLO office in Washington, and remove the PLO as from the terrorist blacklist. But this is has not happened up till the moment. During the meeting, according to senior officials, President Abbas will have some demands to the American administration and President Joe Biden. These are not demands, actually, according to experts. These are Palestinian rights. The main right is to force Israel to stop its aggression, to stop settlement construction, expansion of settlement, as well as the annexation of Palestinian land, and mainly to investigate fairly in the killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. What the American administration and President Joe Biden has brought to the Palestinians are only economic agreements and giving, let's say, millions of dollars as aid to Palestinian hospitals in Al-Quds, as well as aids to the Palestinian Authority, workers and military. Nothing more up till the moment. But experts are saying also the main visit of Biden is to strengthen the relation between some Arab countries and Israel, especially that immediately after ending his meeting with President Abbas, Joe Biden will fly to Saudi Arabia. It's a part of a normalization tie, and he was clear from the beginning, even before arriving to the region, that he was coming like returning back to homeland, Israel, of course, and supporting their main ally, Tel Aviv, and expressing his backup and being sure that the safety and security of Israel is the most important.
Thank you very much for that elaborate explanation. Mona Kendall, our correspondent, joining us live from Ramallah. But in the meantime, Palestinians have rallied in the Gaza Strip to slam the U.S. president's visit to the occupied territories. Biden has been expressing his full support for the Israeli regime since taking office. Ashraf Shannon has more.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have condemned U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to occupied Palestine. Scores of people in the blockaded enclave protested against Biden's visit while shouting slogans in support of resistance actions against the occupying regime. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Tel Aviv on Wednesday to kick off his first trip to the region since taking office. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas accused Joe Biden of putting the interests of the Israeli regime ahead of the legitimate rights of Palestinians and regional security.
The President of the United States of America carries nothing but unlimited support for the Zionist entity, its security and prosperity, and a package of false promises to the Palestinians. The United States' adoption of Zionist plans is based on uprooting our people from their land by force and obliterating their identity and history in favor of the Zionist entity.
During his trip to the occupied territories, Joe Biden visited U.S.-funded missile interception systems, including the so-called Iron Dome and Iron Beam. The Islamic Jihad movement says the U.S. administration only aims to prolong the Israeli occupation and support its aggression against the Palestinian people.
Joe Biden's visit comes to serve the interests of the Zionist entity, and he's not welcomed in our land. We believe that the U.S. and the Zionist regime share the same interests. Joe Biden has ignored the suffering of the Palestinian people and continues to support the Zionist regime.
Palestinians have warned against the dangers of Biden's agenda and the attempts to integrate the Israeli regime into the region and expand the circle of normalization with it. Analysts say that all U.S. administrations have adopted the same biased policy towards the Israeli regime.
When it comes to Israel and Israeli security, there is no difference at all between Republicans and Democrats. What we are witnessing today is that Democratic President Joe Biden support for the deal of the century and his support for further normalization between Israel and the Arab countries.
Palestinians are calling on the free people of the world to reject the arrogance and policies of the United States that target the region's security and stability.
Observers say that Joe Biden's visit will only give the Israeli regime the green light to further violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Moving on to Italy, the Prime Minister Mario Draghi has offered his resignation after a rift with the Five-Star Movement. President Sergio Mattarella has refused the resignation in a bid to overcome the political deadlock. Max Civilli reports from Rome.
On Wednesday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi announced his resignation at the end of a bruising day in which his executive survived a confidence vote on a cost-of-living bill in the Senate, with one of the biggest parties in the government alliance, the Five Star Movement, abstaining from voting. In a statement, Draghi said that the pact of trust at the base of the government's action and the conditions to carry out the executive's program no longer exist. However, President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella rejected Draghi's resignation in an attempt to break the political impasse, inviting the former European Central Bank president to address Parliament and to assess the situation.
I have already said that there won't be a second Draghi government. Let me say, this executive has dealt with the ongoing tensions pretty well.
The Five Star Movement pooled its support for the Draghi government over a bill aimed at helping businesses and households with skyrocketing energy prices and a provision for a trash incinerator in Rome, a project the once anti-establishment party staunchly opposes. The Mario Draghi government was formed after ex-Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte's second executive collapsed in February 2021. Draghi was appointed to address the consequences of the pandemic and to manage about 200 billion euros in grants and low-interest loans from the European Union for a radical restructuring of Italy's economy.
As usual, Draghi destroys the small and medium enterprises and destructure the economy rather than restructure it. The perspective is to transform the Italian economy in a weakened economy that will be a sort of ground for big multinational companies.
Italian President Mattarella takes on a central role now. It's up to him to decide whether to try to persuade outgoing Prime Minister Draghi to form another executive, find a new caretaker leader to take the country to an election next year, or call an early elections in September. October would be an unprecedented event in Italy's political history, as in the autumn, the government generally needs to prepare and pass its budget. Max Civilli, Rome.
And while the war rages on in Donbass, Johnny Miller reports on a kill list associated with the Ukrainian government promoting violence against pro-Russian children.
The notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Verets, meaning peacemaker, it publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. This is Faina Sevenkova. She is 13 years old and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Oles Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Rocelli, an Italian journalist. After he was killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mira Tervets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. This is Yanis Butkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass. He's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have a right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism.
They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. That's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. But like the old saying is that the other's one's terrorist is another one's freedom fighter, and hopefully all sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Chair defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Iran's is no longer a new government, but it is just a year old almost, with what it claims to be a new resolve in making old dreams come true. One dream is reverting from reliance on crude oil exports to a non-oil economy. Well, that's overly ambitious, but to considerably reduce reliance on a single raw resource is perfectly doable, with the right look to management, of course, and a better understanding of macroeconomics.
The year 1404 or 2025 is a target within reach. In financial terms, it's a goal of $75 billion worth of non-oil exports on Iran's agenda. Now, to achieve that volume in 3 years would require more serious investment in certain assets and domains, boosting production being key. For a closer look at those factors, stay with me, Leila Faromarzi, and our show guests here on Iran Today. To meet the $75 billion mark is to strategize in targeting fresh customers and markets. Iran's look to the east and neighbors has been much talked of. Now it is looking more closely at Africa. Its exports to Africa have increased by 100 to 120%, but it's not yet satisfied. Iran exported $1.2 billion worth of non-oil products to African countries last year. Mr. Bozian is an economic analyst active in Kish Free Trade Zone.
In food exports, we can work on sectors on which they cannot work due to weather conditions. I have information that some Iranian goods are exported in bulk, but after being processed, they are packed with the name of another country. This is partly because import regulations in some countries do not allow the imports of processed goods. That's why we emphasize on producing goods with high value added. The value added actually comes from processing the goods. So we need to produce goods that are as close as possible to the final product. What are stone, saffron, or fruits are exported in bulk and then they will be processed or even mixed with other products and then supplied under the name of an African country, for instance. In foodstuff exports, we have advantages. We're also strong in exporting industrial goods like construction materials.
Iran boasts it achieved a $605 million positive trade balance in the first 3 months of the current Iranian calendar year beginning March the 21st, with its non-oil exports having increased 19.5% and foreign transit 32%. This was while the country was undergoing economic reforms and at the same time as the Ukraine war and the Shanghai quarantine, not to forget U.S. sanctions and hostility toward Iranian businessmen. Mr. Sheikhi is an economic analyst who also teaches at university. He came to the studio to share his view of pros and cons with the economic situation while explaining how the cons have not been easy to avoid.
Our non-oil exports increased by 40% in 2021. In the first 3 months of this year, our export levels grew by 19.5%. Our non-oil exports in the first 3 months of this year grew by 21%. In agriculture, if we reform our irrigation system, we can supply products for 300 million people. But our water efficiency is very low. The results of our research are not applied in our farmlands. If they are applied, our production increases by two or threefold. The farms that have reformed their irrigation system water efficiency has quadrupled and production has increased twice or three times the number it was before. This way, the agricultural efficiency has increased by 8 to 9 times. This situation in our agriculture is just an example.
The Trade Promotion Organization TPO head Ali Reza Peymanpak said, during the current government's administration, all ministers and officials that have visited other countries have been accompanied by trade delegations. He continued, exports to Turkey have increased by 100%. And any decrease in exports to Iraq of late are down to the increase in the prices of Iranian goods. And that, in turn, is due to the elimination of the subsidized currency allocations for some goods. Mr. Lahouti is Exports Confederation Chair at Iran's Chamber of Commerce. After a long time, he joined us again, this time on Skype.
If you're talking about a 100% increase in our exports to the United Arab Emirates, this is a huge number and it should be fact-checked. But having a 100% increase in our exports to African countries is feasible, because our trade value with the African countries might be a small number, and a little change can increase it by 100%. Regarding Turkey, I believe that the policy of our current administration and the previous administration have been based on increasing trade volume with neighboring countries, and Turkey is one of our most important trade partners. And in fact, it is among the first 5 destinations of Iran's exports. In the current situation, they've had good cooperation with us. And we even saw the Turkish president making a visit to Iran, and the two countries agreed on some issues. Therefore, thanks to those efforts, the volume of our export to Turkey increased by 40% last year.
The significance of the $75 billion mark is that it is to cover non-oil exports, else the figure per se is nothing new. Because Iran's total exports did reach under $72.5 billion in December of 2021. That was an increase of 11.7% year on year. The country's total imports, on the other hand, recorded under $39 billion in March of 2021. That was a decrease of 11.7% year on year. Why the insistence on non-oil exports is the detrimental effects of single-product oil exports on Iran's economy and past, which linger on till today. In curing old scars, the system wants to develop non-oil exports for continuous economic growth. Getting the country's economy out of the single-product structure would help improve the balance of foreign exchange payments and increase the country's power in global markets.
Our problem is not liquidity, since our banks have enough money in their hands. But the problem is that our banks are not interested in contributing and realizing the country's major goals. They're looking for their own interests. They're constructing trade centers, buildings, and so on. These activities happen inside the country and they cannot be exported. Therefore, the banks should be tasked to have productive activities. On the other hand, some critics say that this way our economy becomes prescriptive. But the problem is that when the banks are engaged in lucrative activities inside the country, they will never turn to exports.
Why the sudden resolve all of a sudden to move from oil exports to non-oil exports? Because we've been talking of it for years and years.
When Ayatollah Raisi became the head of Iran's judiciary, we used to see activities in two sections, productive and non-productive activities. He made non-productive activities partly insecure. He created some restrictions for non-productive activities, and at the same time, he provided facilities for productive activities. For example, during his tenure at the judiciary, he restored around 2,000 out of 5,000 manufacturing units that had been shut down. He assisted productive activities.
Talking of ports and free trade zones, the Sistan-Baluchistan Industry, Mines and Trade Department emphasized the development of exports and proper entry into world markets and maintaining the conditions of survival in them cannot be achieved except by creating a clear and sustainable export strategy that has become unchangeable by law and each of the executive agencies.
We don't have an industrial strategy and we don't have a correct trade strategy either. And if we have one, we're not committed to it. If you take a look at our country's development plans, the only one which was successful by over 50% was the fourth development plan. And the rest I've seen have been implemented by less than 30%. This shows that we're not committed to the programs that we have set out, and we lose potentials during the implementation phase. Therefore, I believe that we have untapped potentials in exports, but unfortunately, we did not succeed in taking advantage of them. In the final 3 years of Iran's previous administration, our national currency depreciated, and that could help increasing our export income, but we couldn't make it.
To remove logistical obstacles to achieving its goals, Iran is going to have to do some serious investing. We are talking intensive infrastructure development in energy, transportation, and communication, which is what connected the traditional economic powerhouses of the West with new centers of influence in the East and South. What would you say are the logistical hindrances to reverting from oil exports to non-oil exports?
Our logistic barriers include a decrease in investment within the past 80 years. In particular, we have witnessed a decrease in our net investment. Our gross investment, which includes depreciation, has been very low or even none. When the government publicly concedes defeat and says that all of our programs are intertwined to sanctions, it practically stops all kinds of investments. They also rely on foreigners and say that whenever the Western countries start cooperating with us, our problems will be solved. But we've seen the opposite. According to the statistics of Iran's central bank, we had negative growth in the first two quarters of the previous Iranian year. But the economic growth in the third and fourth quarters of the same year were 5.7%. This is while the growth of our oil sales was just 0.2%. This shows that our economy was activated because we had new managers. The new government said that we can do it.
Iran's sanctions-imposed isolation from international markets was concurrent with the period in which these markets saw unprecedented levels of integration and interconnectivity. And now to catch up, globalization is at the top of Iran's post-sanctions economic agenda. In talking connectivity, no doubt working on transportation routes for shipping out exports is of paramount importance, as is diplomacy to secure relations with third countries on transit routes between, say, Iran and Russia.
The alliance of the sanction club is actually changing. The Western countries have realized since 10 to 15 years ago that the dollar is falling. They have been looking for replacement for the huge bulk of dollar notes that are not supported by the proportionate gross domestic product. If this money is sent back to the United States and Europe at once, they cannot compensate the ensuing loss. So they decided to resolve this complicated situation, and then they introduced cryptocurrency to the world.
Chamber of Commerce Chief Shafi pointed to Iran's inadequate port infrastructure and called the unavailability of ro-ro ships a serious weakness in trade relations between Iran and Russia. There are problems to fix also in the rail and road transportation sectors, including the low speed of rail transportation and the increase in the cost of goods. Bursan Bazar observes, infrastructure is foundational in a very literal sense, and functional geography is more important than political geography. Rather than focus on how the world is organized across political borders and alliances, we should focus on how we actually use the world through infrastructure. The reason is, infrastructure provides connectivity, and with the present tug-of-war between security and connectivity, connectivity seems to be the winner in securing relations between countries. At least that's how it's been between Iran and the US and China.
The swap of Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan was just the first step. The train that crossed Iran into Turkey when Turkmenistan's president was in Iran had started its journey from China. As you know, railroad is the most efficient way to transport goods. For example, if you compare the duration of transportation, you see that a journey from China to Europe that takes 45 days on a ship will be completed in 5 days with a train. We see that rail corridors from the east to the west are being activated, and Iran is on this international path. These corridors are activating Shanghai Cooperation and Eurasia pacts. Now, we see that more countries are bidding to join these pacts as new member states. This way, Iran's economy will be boosted significantly.
Just look at the 2015 nuclear deal between Iran, the US, and other world powers. Iran and the US did not develop any closer ties than before. That's because the US showed it had little to offer by way of connectivity when it didn't lift primary sanctions off Iran, as expected by the deal. Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
More coming up, but first a quick diversion into global media to see what other outlets have said. Here's how they put it in print. The Financial Tribune reads, Iran's first combine tea harvester, rice seedling planter unveiled. The first combine tea harvester and rice seedling planter made in Iran have been unveiled and production lines have been set up for their large-scale industrial production, according to the head of the Agricultural Mechanization Expansion Center. The combine tea harvester has a 74-horsepower engine and can reap yields from 2 hectares of farms per day. Talking of trade with Africa, the Monitor reads, Museveni seeks barter trade with Iran government. President Museveni has proposed barter trade, the exchange of goods for goods and services for services, as one of the ways of boosting trade with sanctions hit Iran, because it would bypass the global banking system, which predominantly uses the United States dollar. The Uganda-Iran barter trade system would certainly attract scrutiny from Washington, which gives Uganda nearly $1 billion each year, mainly for health and security support. The State Minister for International Relations, Mr. Okello Oryem, told Daily Monitor last evening that there is no standard way of trading around the world, and by engaging in barter trade, Kampala would not be breaking any international law. We've a piece that puts my mind to ease because I was so worried about the escape of brains from this country. The Tehran Times reads, Iranian knowledge-based products hit markets in 70 countries. Iranian knowledge-based companies that marketed their products in 70 countries and in some global markets have overtaken European and American companies, Siavash Maliki said. He's deputy head of the Innovation and Prosperity Fund. In the last 2 days, the number of knowledge-based companies has exceeded 6,800, he stated, emphasizing that half of them are active in the field of electronics and electricity. Last year, knowledge-based companies gained about $800 million in revenues from export, and in the current year, which started March the 21st, it seems to have reached over $1 billion. Today, the country's knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the GDP, he said. That'll be it for the news segment today. Here in the second half of the show, it's about time for more facts and figures. Exports in Iran increased to $18,850 million in 2022 from $17,285 million in the second quarter of 2021. That's according to the CBI, Central Bank of Iran. Oil and natural gas being Iran's most important exports, they account for 82% of the country's export revenues thus far. Other exports include chemicals, plastics, fruit, ceramic products, and metals. This country's foreign trade hit over 41.5 million tons, valued at over $29.5 billion in the last 3 months of the previous Persian year, or first quarter of 2022, according to Said Ruhollah Latifi, that spokesman for IRCA, Iran's Customs Administration. Iran exported under 30.5 million tons of non-oil goods valued at under $13.5 billion from January the 22nd to March the 20th, 2022, recording a 10 and 39% growth in terms of weight and value, respectively, said Latifi. Over $122.7 million worth of products were exported from the country last year, showing a 9 and 40% growth in terms of weight and value, respectively, as compared to the same period of the year before.
Our technical and engineering exports
and take over our oil exports. I was gathering information about an expo in Syria, and I saw that Iran has failed to take part in that expo. This is while Iran has played a big role in the reconstruction of Syria, as well as providing raw materials and engineering services. But for some reason, Iran missed out on that event.
Now, to go back to alliances, as far as the focus on neighbors goes, President Raisi stated the Islamic Republic of Iran has a high geopolitical capacity that provides the basis for strengthening regional convergence and the spread of peace and prosperity among the nations of the region from the Indian Ocean and Persian Gulf and Black Sea to Europe.
In the first year of Iran's current administration, we had an average increase of 30% in our export levels. Therefore, if we continue with the same speed, it's possible to achieve the $75 billion targets by the end of the current administration's four-year term. But we have to take into account that improving exports requires preconditions. I mean, if we have the target of $75 billion of exports, we have to improve the knowledge of our cooperation and improve our packaging industry, which is one of our weak points. We also need to have plans to improve our transportation. Weakness in transportation has already damaged our foreign trade badly. We need to have plans to provide more refrigerator trucks for our agricultural sector.
Then there's the potential Iran-Russia-Venezuela energy bloc. Those three countries have huge potential to thwart sanctions on their energy sectors if they cooperate, Iran maintains. An alliance of the sanctioned club, so to speak. Although U.S. sanctions against the energy industries of these three countries are of a different nature in each case. The Iran-Russia-Venezuela energy axis would have great potential to influence world markets, given they hold 45% of the world's oil reserves. Venezuela, with the world's largest oil reserves, has 303 billion barrels of crude, while Iran has 157 billion and Russia 89 billion. Iran has been lending Venezuela a helping hand since 2020. To revive that country's oil and refining industries. How? By sending technical help and shipping oil and gasoline to the Latin American country. Also, recently, the two states signed a good many agreements during Venezuelan President Maduro's visit to Iran. As for how much the Ukraine war might have affected Iranian sales, Iran says its oil sales have remained at relatively high levels as it is exporting more than 1 million barrels of crude oil and gas condensate per day. And it's not just down to global oil prices having increased basically because of the Ukraine war, but because there has been a considerable increase in actual oil sales by the government and more success in receiving the money for it. Outside sources, however, have claimed that Iran's crude exports have taken a big hit given Western sanctions on Russia have prompted that country to pump its oil east with a discount, greater discounts than Iran has managed to give China, its largest buyer of oil.
Iran is an oil-rich country, and its budget has been based on oil sales until 3 years ago, when the U.S. unfair sanctions hit the country hard. When the administrations faced problems in providing foreign exchange resources, they turned to non-oil exports, and at the end of the previous administration, we succeeded in providing the required financial resources from non-oil exports.
Earlier in April, Oil Minister Javad Orji said Iran's oil production levels had reached the pre-sanctions levels of over 3.8 million barrels. Among reasons for this, he said, were finding new customers and markets, using different methods and oil contracts, and making use of highly qualified experts in the field. Also, according to Orji, Iran's gas condensate exports rose nearly fourfold over 8 months. They reached nearly 240,000 barrels per day at the end of the calendar year, leading up to March the 20th, 21st. That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. We'll be back on at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Rabbana! Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 of As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyya for Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn Zain al-Abidin alayhi salamullah. In this supplication, the Imam alayhi salam seeks refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from number of things. And we got up to the part where the Imam alayhi salam, he says to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, O Allah, I seek refuge in you from shakasatul akhlaq. When we said shakasatul akhlaq is when he looks at his character, and especially when we're talking about moral character, it's what defines a human being, is your moral character. It's not your wealth, it's not your fame, it's not your lineage, it's not your looks. It is your character, morally. How are you living amongst people? And from here, we see that even in Islam, they classified it into three parts. You have fundamentals, you have worship acts, and you have akhlaq. So akhlaq plays a massive role in the life of a mu'min and in the life of a Muslim, to be more general. Now, we did say that when it comes to akhlaq, there are many benefits that a person gets when he adopts these traits and this trait. And we mentioned some of them. So let us continue with the list to see what we can learn from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in this regard. Before we continue, let us take a short break and then we will come back.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana,
welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program, A Bridge, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. When it comes to husnul khuluq, having the best of moral traits, the hadith tells us that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, those who have the best of akhlaq, best of moral character, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala increases their rizq. Their sustenance is increased. And vice versa. Those who have bad akhlaq, bad moral traits, their rizq becomes a lot less. And they become poorer and poorer by the day. For example, we have a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam. And he says, بِحُسْنِ الْخُلْقِ تُدُرُّ الْأَرْزَاقِ. With your good manners, or by good manners, sustenance will be opened from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The gates of rizq will be opened upon you based on your akhlaq. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, Husnul khuluq min ad-deen wa huwa yazidu fi rizq. Having moral traits is a part of religion. And as a result, he says, yuzid for rizq, it will increase his sustenance. Now, me and you, we constantly in this life, we want to have money zero. We want to have many zeros in our bank accounts. Isn't that how it is? I work day and night just so I could make more money. Me and you, we want to make more money. Now, sometimes there are easier way to make money. Sometimes there are harder way to make money. One of the easiest ways to make money is by having akhlaq. And mind you, having said that, when we talk about rizq, it is not just wealth and materialistic matter. That's just one aspect of rizq. We have a spiritual rizq where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives a person and he gifts him the best of akhlaq. He makes him a lovable person, a person who is easygoing, a person who is constantly smiling, a person who is constantly not angry, a person who, you know, more forgiving when it comes to other people. When he talks and walks and deals with people, he deals with them in a better trait. Sometimes we see a lot of people who are not mu'mineen, but they have the best of akhlaq. Let us take a break and then we continue right after.
Listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So just before the break, we were saying that having akhlaq, in fact, it increases your sustenance in terms of materialistic matter and in terms of spirituality, which as human beings, we need both of them. Another aspect of having good akhlaq and good moral traits is that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, they say, when it comes to your house, when it comes to your place of living, you want to have the best of it, right? You want to live in a place where it is at least comfortable and relaxing. The Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, Al-birr wa husnul khuluq yu'ammiran ad-diyar. Being kind to your parents and having the best of akhlaq, it makes your houses more livable. In terms of what? For example, if I live with a partner and me and my partner are constantly fighting, and I had the best of akhlaq towards my partner and my partner has the worst of akhlaq with me, then this house won't last long. It will break down. So all the members in the house, if one of them or many of them have bad akhlaq, it will disrupt the peace in the house. While if they have good akhlaq, both of them, all of them, then the house will prosper. The house will be, you know, livable. The house will be comfortable. This house would be relaxing. A person, when he leaves his house, he would love to come back and spend more time with his family or with his loved ones. Why? Because they have this love between each other. Sometimes you see a lot of people, they say, I don't want to go home. And you say, why? Because, oh, my wife is like this. Or because my husband is like this. I prefer to stay outside. Now that's a problem. That's a disaster. When we have akhlaq and we deal with each other based on our akhlaq, then life goes smoothly and beautifully. And we ended with this. Also, having the best of akhlaq increases one's life. The imam says, وَيُزِيدَانِ فِي الْأَعْمَارِ. If you want to live longer, have a best of akhlaq. It's simple, easy. The more you are nice to people, the more Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will increase your lifespan. As simple as that. So husn al-khuluq has many effects. Inner effect and has outer effect. So let us adopt the best of akhlaq. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.